Hello, I am Allison. I am an alcoholic addict. Can everybody hear me okay?
Yeah.
I was doing okay until you told me this was going to be recorded. But that's fine. Very grateful to be here tonight. It's funny, my sponsor told me, you know, it's not service if it doesn't hurt. So here we go. I grew up in California and on the peninsula in Menlo Park. I had a pretty normal childhood. My parents were married. They still are married. I'm actually sitting in their house right now where I grew up, which I know is pretty unique. But growing up, my father was, he was a businessman. He was very busy. He traveled to and from Berkeley from Menlo Park. And my mom was a teacher and, somewhat of a normal relationship, but my dad was somewhat angry. It was kind of unpredictable with us from my brother and I growing up. I have an older brother, who's 2 years older than me. And, you know, there was no drinking in the house at all. My dad doesn't drink at all. I think he'd experimented in college and he's never really extrapolated on this, but he said he liked it a lot and he was too worried he would get out of control. So he never did that. So I've always kind of wondered if there was like an addiction on that side, but he doesn't talk much about stuff like that. And my mom is very much a social drinker, like one glass of wine every now and then. But going back to growing up, my brother was kind of a nerd growing up. He didn't quite fit in. He bumped heads with my father, and developed some emotional problems, which, you know, my mom was coddled him a lot and protected him from my dad. And, he ended up having such emotional problems that he became suicidal. And, when he was around 13, he tried to commit suicide. And I think it did surround somewhat of a relationship with my father. There was some physical abuse there. I was only ever once pushed once or twice by my dad. That was more aimed towards my brother. So he did go to he was put in a mental hospital. And I believe he was 13. And I really dealt with all of the family drama at home by going over to a friend's house, my best friend growing up. And at her house, she had an older sister, and her older sister kind of broke in her parents. So we were able to drink there. And their kind of school of thought was, if we're going to drink, you know, it might as well be at their house where they know that we were safe. So I started drinking probably around when I was like 11. I mean, like taking sips of beer here and there. And then as I got into high school, we would get beer all the time. Our parents would buy us beer. We would drink beer at our house and we would have our friends over. And so that was, you know, starting into high school. And then during high school, I always just had this desire to like take it to a next level. And somehow I don't know if I knew about cocaine, but I knew like there was something that you can snort to put up your nose. And I was interested and curious about it. And I had a friend who had connections and I got into crank. And I know this was like 1997. So I don't know if it wasn't quite coke and it wasn't like meth, but it was something that kept you up. I'm sure it was like a mix of stuff under the kitchen cabinet. So I was doing that. I was doing crank in high school. I was getting drunk a lot, but at the same time, I was a really good student. So my parents never questioned anything. I was, I got pretty much a 4.0 and was good. As long as I was doing good in school, then there was no questions asked. So, I ended up going to school on the East Coast. I went to school in Boston and, you know, I was It's funny. I experimented with hard drugs when I was in high school, and then when I went away to school, I really didn't do hard drugs. I was more of like a big drinker. You know, it was like very much the party mode. You know, when I hung out with people that drank a lot, I don't think that anyone was necessarily an addict, but everyone was drinking. Like, everyone would get a handle of vodka. I mean, we were definitely drinking a lot, but so anyways, let me fast forward a little bit more. I'm taking up a lot of time. So, sorry, I just skipped a huge part. Before I went to college, I went on a senior trip to Mexico, and again, drink tons of drinking, because there you're 18 and you could drink. And I ended up getting raped there, and I that affected me, which I never gave it a lot of weight, because I was really drunk and it was an older guy that I was saying no to. It wasn't violent rape. It was just kind of like a passive thing where I was like, no, I don't want to do this. No, I don't want to do this. And then it happened. And that really affected my future relationships with men. And I've just recently discovered this. Again, really didn't give much weight. So going back to college, I had a serious boyfriend. I did sleep around a little bit. I mean, I think that this rape really did affect, like I said, my relationships with men and my outlook on men. When I got out of college, I went home back to Menlo Park, and there's a lot of cocaine here. And I fell into a crowd where I was doing a lot of it. I was working up in the city and commuting from my parents' house up to the city. I ended up moving to the city, was in hospitality. So there's a lot of partying there, a lot of cocaine throughout my 20s, a lot of sleeping around throughout my 20s. I ended up meeting my husband, who I'm married to now. And he also partied a lot of cocaine, a lot of drinking. And we ended up getting married. His parents actually use cocaine and drink. So that was a really cool thing when I found him. So there was a lot of that. And as we were, you know, settling down to be married, we've now been married for 10 years, about 5 years in, you know, we had been trying to get pregnant, and I found out I had some infertility problems. And we ended up doing IVF. And at the time, I had actually switched careers just to kind of focus on this, because I was having such problems with getting pregnant. So the infertility diagnosis really affected my headspace, my marriage, a lot of things. And I'd say that around that time, I also switched careers, and I had to expose to, I didn't have to, but I did expose to my employer that I was going in for IVF treatments. And long story short, I ended up getting fired from that job. And I'd say that was when I came back from getting the process of getting the egg retrieval and putting it in my body and trying to get pregnant. I came back to work and they fired me. And the following week I found out it didn't work. And I'd say that was really when things started to spin out of control, which is about 5 years ago. And I, you know, my usage increased. I did end up getting pregnant. And during that time when I was pregnant, I developed really bad headaches. I wasn't using or drinking during this time. Developed really bad headaches. I got put on Norco's for my headaches, because that's the only medicine I could take. And I became addicted to that. And my pregnancy was extremely hard. My daughter 6 weeks early, and was on these painkillers for a long time, so I was breastfeeding. I eventually got off of those. And, you know, I found ways. I started stealing pills from my mother-in-law, who had a pharmacy underneath her cabinet. And then you know, my daughter's now she's four and a half years old. We did try and get pregnant about 2 years ago, or year and a half ago. And we got pregnant again via IVF, and we lost that baby. Well, right into the first trimester. And again, that tailspin took a deep dive. I was also back on the painkillers again because I developed this preeclampsia, essentially, like the signs of preeclampsia with the high blood pressure and headaches as soon as I got pregnant. After that, I fell into a deep, deep, dark depression. I began using things like anything I could get my hands on. Around a couple months after we lost the baby, I found out that my husband was online chatting with people, and this was like right before COVID hit, and I just everything went completely haywire. So as I ended up, stealing more pills. I ended up getting caught by my mother-in-law, and she confronted me. And this was in July, and I said, I need help. And I was, thank God, I got caught, and I completely surrendered and ended up going to Serenity Knowles, which is a treatment center in Marin, and I went there for 30 days and. You know, I knew nothing about AA. I knew nothing about recovery. And I've dove right in. I mean, I can't believe how my life is still pretty hard. I'm actually in the process of being separated from my husband. I think that this is a way I need to go, but I've been able to gain the clarity and just the wisdom and the support from AA and my sponsor and my sponsor family. And, it's been unbelievable. And being able to dive deep into these psychological issues that I did have. And I mean, my God, I can't remember half of my 20s cause I drank to blackout so many times, and the amount of dangerous situations I put myself in, I'm just grateful to be alive. And, grateful for AA, and grateful to be asked to speak tonight. Going through, I think I'd mentioned in the beginning, before the meeting started, I'm going through a pretty hard time with separating from my husband. Today was a hard day, just meeting him and getting my daughter from him, and him just saying some hard things. And normally, like a year ago, I'd be diving into like a bag of Coke or diving into a bottle and a knot. I mean, be able to sit in these feelings and be uncomfortable with them but process and know what I need to do and kind of see where my next steps are, even though I know it's going to be really hard, but I feel like it's going to be okay. So, thank you. Thank you so much for having me speak.
He ain't gonna let nobody turn me around, turn me around. Turn me around, ain't gonna let nobody turn me around. I got to keep on walking, keep on talking, marching up the freedom road. I start off with a Negro spiritual because the spiritual was the first forms of nonviolent resistance. The enslaved Africans used these songs as a means to tell of their experiences, their strength, hope, and their courage to overcome insurmountable experiences. And they used song as a way to open up the space and to open up a place where others might be able to hear their journey, hear their stories. There's a great African-American writer whose name is John Edgar Wideman. And John Edgar Wideman wrote, "The process for me that's going to knit up the culture, the fabric, the collective fabric of the family, all of us, is that we tell our stories, that we keep on telling them in our own ways, and they express our own values, and we keep on telling them despite the chaos, despite the madness, and despite the pressure not to tell. I welcome each opportunity to tell and share my story. And I thank you for inviting me here. My name is T. Michael R., and I am a grateful recovering alcoholic and addict. And it gives me great joy to be here to talk about my journey, and why and how those words can perhaps help someone else. But selfishly, every time I share, it helps me. The opportunity to speak my truth emboldens me to be more authentic, more unapologetic, more earnest and authentic. And that's what's really great about having a program like this, like AA, is that so many of us get a chance to come into these rooms and we sometimes take for granted, I take for granted the power that comes from this sanctuary, this sacred space. And as a sacred space, we honor traditions and we honor each other. I think about myself and I think about Allison, and I wanted to say to you, Allison, thank you so much for your share, for your being so open and willing to be so vulnerable and so exposed and so honest and so thoughtful. And that means so much to me as a listener, and I can't help but imagine it meant a lot to so many of us who were here in this chat today or this evening. I want to share just how things were for me at the beginning. And much of it aligned a lot with what Allison was talking about. It's interesting. I think as alcoholics, many of us are overachievers, you know, manipulators, overachievers, caretakers, all those things, peacemakers. And I spent my high school years, not unlike what Allison spoke of, but when I came into this world, I was a bubbly, bouncing, big head baby boy. Ooh, Lord, I had a big old head. There was far more of me above the neck than below. And I had to wear braces. I had rickets when I was born. See, I'm telling my age, because most of y'all out there don't know what rickets is, do you? Y'all going to look it up on your little phone, rickets. It's a deficiency of vitamin D that people who were born in the 50s had, because their mother didn't have the sort of natal care. So I wore leg braces, and I didn't walk till I was three. So that gave me a different purview and a different way of coming into the world. I flipped around like a little baby seal from place to place for the first 3 years of my life. And that kind of informed my journey. I was a sickly kid. I had a lot of health concerns, ear, hearing, respiratory, asthma, just a lot of stuff. And I came to find out later in life that much of that had to do with the fact that I spent my first 3 years on the floor around dust and dirt and contaminants and things that made the respiratory situation great or more severe. Nonetheless, I bounced out of those braces into the world at full steam. I was fearless and I was determined and committed to do something and anything that allowed me to live out loud. And I did that. And my father was in the military. He was an induction officer, he's a psychiatrist. Yes, I said that. My father is a black psychologist. And I say black and preface it that way because there's a whole bunch of business in that whole scenario. But we can talk about that another time. But he was a psychiatrist in the military. So he went to induction offices around the country to help men and women at the time who were conscientious objectors and people who used to paint the American flag on their bodies or going nude or doing anything they could think of to figure out a way not to go to war. And he would tell them that they were either crazy or they weren't. And most of them, in my opinion, weren't crazy. Who wants to go into war that was unnecessary? It was Vietnam at the time. In any event, I moved more times than I was old by the time I was nine. When I was 9 years old, I had already moved 10 times. So that informed how I dealt with people. I always tried to make people laugh. I always tried to have the wittiest comment. I always wanted to do something to fit in. And fitting in is what happened for me. We heard in our earlier share that fitting in was something that came second nature for me specifically. But by 10 and 11, I was drinking, smoking marijuana, pot, reefer, dope, whichever one we want to call it. And by the time I was in middle school, I was already engaging in everything from Dilaudids to Quaaludes to the whole nine yards, but still doing my work at school, kind of that overachiever thing. And had the similar sort of responses from my parents about, as long as you do well in school, you must not be that bad off, you know. I left high school and headed into college, went to the University of Texas at Austin. got my did my degrees in marketing, then in finance, and I was miserable. I spent 6 years of my life getting a degree in something I hated. And if I could say anything to anyone within the sound of my voice, do yourself a favor and do what you love and do what your passion is, because granted, Lord knows it shows up sideways, and it came out sideways with me. My drinking got worse. My weight got heavier. My drug use got more expansive. My sexual addiction became more out of control. And by the time I got out of the job situation that I was in, in 1983, because it was October of 1983 that I was diagnosed with a condition called GRID, gay-related immune deficiency. And GRID was the first term that soon became known as AIDS or HIV/AIDS. And so that diagnosis, in my mind and based on how people behaved at the time, it sealed my fate. It was the end of my life, and I had no reason to do anything more than just go out the world backwards. So I spent the first year in a bottle and in any drug that I could get into my system. I went from that to a space of probably having a home, a house, a car, you know, all the things that people try to aspire to get. Well, by the time the second year after my diagnosis, I was living homeless on the streets. I didn't lose anything. I gave it all to the dope man and to bars and to liquor stores. And so by the time that happened, I found the rooms. I knew that I had to do something. And I slid into one of the rooms of an AA meeting, just trying to find just some sanity. And it didn't stick, but I knew that there was something out there for me. I went back out onto the streets, went back out to using. And finally, I got a bolt of lightning hit me. I called my family and said, look, I need help. My family figured out a way to get me to a place called Hazelden, which is here in Minnesota. And I went to Hazelden in 1989. So I spent approximately 6 years of my life engaging in full-fledged alcohol and chemical dependency and a drug addiction, trying to fight my way back to life. And after 6 years, I realized I was still here. So I said, what the frick? I might as well try to live as opposed to keep trying to kill myself. So I ended up at Hazelden, and that was probably the beginning of a new life. I ended up there having been addicted to heroin and cocaine. I was a speedballer, and I got to Hazelden, and I was experiencing withdrawal and pneumonia. And at the time, I was the only African-American in the entire facility, in the entire treatment center of Hazelden, which left me sincerely wondering if I could ever get sober, because no one looked like me, and I didn't know anyone who was sober when I was in Texas. So there's another added element to the fact that I really didn't think I would succeed. But finally, I managed to get through the 6 months I was there. I went to a place called Jelnik, which is an advanced stay facility inside Hazelden. And then I went to a halfway house. And then I started really engaging in real active participation in AA. And that changed my life. It turned my life around. Stepping into these rooms, I realized that we were a bunch of damaged automobiles with fenders hanging off and broken headlights and doors that don't quite shut properly. But with time and with sharing our stories and being here with each other, we found a way to soften the edges of the cars, the car bumpers, and lift things back up and put ourselves back together again. And that's what I found, a space to put myself back together again. And that was very helpful for me, and it provided me with some hope. I remember my first sponsor told me that you have to get humble, you have to get honest. And he shared that to be humble is not to think less of yourself, but to think of yourself less, to be selfless, not to really spend energy invested in trying. He said also, do good and disappear. He used to always say that. I love that phrase. Do good and disappear. And I think of my own family, because I'm from a freedman town, a town settled by freed slaves in Texas. One of the pearls of wisdom that the old folks would say is is services the rent due for living on this planet. And there's something to be said about what AA does. It provides an opportunity for that type of service, for that type of caring for mankind. My grandfather told me, boy, you was born with 2 degrees, a degree in accounting and a degree in humanities. You're accountable for your own behavior, and you're a human being who needs to care for other human beings with respect, with dignity, and with concern and compassion. So he said, you got 2 degrees you were born with, shouldn't be no problem getting a third one. So as I mentioned earlier, I went ahead and got those degrees, but they weren't what I loved. When I finally got out of treatment, when I finally got out of the halfway house in Minnesota, where I currently reside in St. Paul, here I am with my degrees selling yogurt in a Skyway. I don't know if anybody in California knows what a Skyway is. You have no reason to know what a Skyway is. A Skyway is one of those little overland bridges, because we get snow here up to 3-4 feet sometimes. And all of downtown St. Paul and Minneapolis is linked together by little bridges, like little hamster chutes that go from one building to another round. So you can get all the way around downtown Minnesota, downtown St. Paul or Minneapolis through the Skyway system. And they have shops and places you can eat on the Skyway. It's really quite fascinating. It's a great way to accommodate people. But in any event, I was selling yogurt in the Skyway. I always thought it'd be nice to sing. I've always loved singing. And thinking that I would one day want to go to school to do that, I didn't have the courage or at the time. But I would sing selling yogurt. Have some yogurt, have a twist. How about some yogurt sprinkles like yogurt today? You know, I just make up songs. This guy from the Minnesota Opera Company singing, and he said, dude, why don't you come audition for Showboat? I came, auditioned, got, and next thing I knew, I was an actor, what I'd always dreamed for. The promises are real. And my other family member, my aunt mama, A-I-N apostrophe T, she ain't your mama back yet. She was really my grandfather's cousin, but we called her aunt mama. She used to say, baby, you know what potential means? Means you ain't doing nothing right now. Ain't never gonna do it. Potential don't make groceries, don't pay bills, don't do nothing. But go on ahead and do it. So I did like what she said. I went ahead and decided I was gonna be an actor, gonna be a performer. And that's what I ended up doing. Minnesota Opera Company and the Houston Grand Opera. We did Showboat, La Boheme, Madame Butterfly. We did Showboat in Egypt on the Nile. Now that's a weird concept. The song that we sang, Colored Folks Work on the Mississippi, on the Nile. Now, that's some shit for you right there. That's a whole nother conversation, too. But anyway, I digress and go back to the fact that I left my job. I left the job at the yogurt shop, started singing with the Minnesota Opera Company, and there was no turning back. The reality, when I got out of treatment and from Hazelden, got out of the halfway house, I lived on the streets of St. Paul because I still didn't have any place to go, and my family and I were estranged because I absconded with much of my father's business and a lot of money from the family. And so we were still estranged. So I couldn't go back to Texas. And for some of us here, we know that, you know, we have the wreckage of our past that keeps us from returning home sometimes. And we keep moving forward. And there's those relationships that get damaged that really are hard to repair. So the first theater that I worked in from the Minnesota Opera Company was the theater where I used to sleep out on the street or hang out in front of. So it was really quite an honor to know that once again, the promises can be realized in your life when you allow yourself to step into your truth, plant your feet, claim your space, and speak to the room. And that's what I really had a chance to do when I finally discovered my own voice. You know, there's something really beautiful about being able to live in your own skin and be able to name who you are and not be ashamed of yourself. And sobriety has given me that sense of confidence. So in 1989, I went from sleeping on the streets of St. Paul to performing in the space that I used to sleep out in the streets in front of. That's what the promises do, and that's what they've done for me. It has allowed me to go on to do even more great and amazing things. I continue to go to meetings, and it's really a cornerstone of my sobriety. And people laugh. I'm 32 years sober now, and in recovery for 32 years. And people ask me, why do you still go to meetings? And I said, why do you still breathe? Come on now. I mean, it's my life force that I summon up from meetings. It is what gives me the possibility to have had the experiences I've had and still be here. You know, and that's something very powerful, very encouraging to know that to do something and be successful at it every day. I know people say, and I know it's true, I know there's a God that ain't me, but I'm perfect. I'm perfect because I'm made in a divine and perfect image, and there's something I do every day I don't use. I don't know anyone else who's not in this program who can honestly say that they've arrived at a form of perfection that not experienced in any other thing. I derive the sense of satisfaction and completeness that I get from my dreams being sober. And that's just beautiful. That's amazing and astounding. And it happens because I choose not to drink. I remember my mantra when I was in treatment. I used to say, I can not drink. As opposed to say, I can't. I can not drink. I can not use. And my other mantra was, this would help me stop smoking. Whether I smoke or not, the craving will go away. And invariably, most of the time, that was true. It took me more years to stop smoking cigarettes than it did to stop using heroin. Now, that's some shit for you right there. I let you know, if you're smoking right now, you got a monkey on your back that won't quit. And, well, you know, don't worry about it. It'll subside if that's what you want to do. Makes me think about people in the rooms, and you probably heard in some of the books that you read, if you read the daily readers, the story of the woman who was talking in a meeting, and she said, oh my goodness, I don't know if I can ever become a nurse. It's going to take me 5 years, and I got to do this and spend this much. Well, whether you become a nurse or not, 5 years will pass. So do what you love. Do what's intended for you. You've got to take hold of your own life. And that's what I've been trying to do, and I've been able to do. I went from being homeless on the streets, being at a theater that I used to sleep outside the streets from, to in 2013 getting an award from that same organization for being Educator of the Year. Because I went from not teaching. I taught when I was in grad school. I taught K-12, and I started teaching again. I teach at the University of Minnesota. I'm an affiliate professor, been doing it for 18 years, and I've been awarded for that in 2008. I received a regional Emmy Award for a production that I did that spoke to sesquicentennial year states. And those are states that have been in existence for 150 years. I did the narration for it and got a regional Emmy for that. I had a chance to speak to sing for President Obama when he came to Minnesota. I was selected as the person to sing the national anthem for him and Jimmy Carter. I say these things not braggadociously. I say these things because these are the things that come as a result of doing what this program asks us to do. And that's not use, not pick up, not put a glass to our lips. You know, it takes strength, courage, and the wisdom of those who've gone before you to do this work. There's a song by India Irie. I don't know if you all even know, are familiar with the artist, but it's called Strength, Courage, and Wisdom. And it goes, inside my head there is a dream that I want to see in the sun. Behind my eyes there is a me that I've been hiding for much too long, because I've been too afraid to let it show, because I'm scared of the judgment that may follow. Always putting off my living for tomorrow. Got to step out on faith. And that's what you got to do. You can't put off your living for tomorrow. You got to step out on faith. That's what I've been doing. Asking other people to step out on the faith that they have. Step out on the things that seem almost impossible. Because we can do it. You know, Dr. Martin Luther King has a quote And I think this is the most powerful one of all the quotes for me. And it is, in the end, we may not remember the words of our enemies, but we will remember the silence of our friends. How many of us have been so impacted by friends who have been silent when we needed them most, who didn't step up and support us? That's where the most damage and the biggest dents in my car, my chassis, have come from, those people who I felt weren't there for me. And whether that's their truth, my truth is what matters for me. And perception's more real than true. And that's the part that's so hard for other people who say, well, you did this, you did. And that's not how I saw it, you know? And so I say all that just simply to say I went on a tangent there when I shared that little tidbit there. But there's something that can be said about what we do with each moment of our life if we choose not to use. And that's what I keep saying, that same slogan, because it is there's nothing we can hammer in more earnestly and more sincerely than just that. I know that some of us here have probably heard people say, I have my sponsor used to always tell me, well, if you're going to use, call me first. I'll drink with you. You know, it was always like it was his way of saying, you're not going to call, you're not going to use. I'm not going to drink. So I really remember those phrases from him, and it made a big difference. It made a big difference for me. And there's so many other things I could share. I don't know what my time looks like. What is it? I got a whole 7 minutes. Well, let me tell you about when I was two, I remember the time, and then I remember Mrs. Pearson's art class in fifth grade. No, let me stop. I will just share a couple more things that I think are pertinent to our conversation here. They're really cogent to what we're discussing. And that is how we live in service, how service is the rent due for living on this planet. And I think the service that we owe each other is figuring out what we can do to make the lives of others better by living our lives more sincerely, more authentically, and with more honesty and with more sense of purpose. There's the story of these two stonemasons. When the first one was asked, "What are you doing?" he replied, "Making a brick." When the second was asked, he answered, "Building a cathedral." We have to see the big picture. We can view our lives as people who are making bricks, or we can view our lives as people who are building cathedrals. What's your choice? It is really about understanding where we're going and what we want to see happen for our life. And I know for me, as much as the using days, and I could have spent a lot more time talking about using and all that stuff, but that we all know that story. We all have our own independent. We are the expert of our experience, and we know that story far too well. And that's why we're in this room right now. You know, when I was talking about Dr. King, about not being silent, what I want to really challenge each person here to do is to really step to someone, that's how I say it, not step up, but step to someone and let them know about you, one thing about you. Take a risk. Because every time we share, like when Allison said, "Oh shit, this is going to be recorded. Damn it, I wasn't ready for that." But she stepped into that risk and she did it. And there's something to be have great pride about having done that, you know? So that being said, I love that. Chief, this big ass 5 minute sign came up. That was funny as hell. That's funny. Thank you, Kat. I appreciate that. Good looking out, because the brother will talk. but I before I went on my other tangent, I will say that the quote that I was telling you about from Dr. King, and I was saying about, you know, the fact that we may not remember the silence of we'll remember the silence of our friends. We have to speak up. We have to speak up and speak out. Act up, act out, act a fool, but act. Do something. Do something to be of service, to change the world around us. We all have the power. We can't do everything, but we can do something. So decide what that something is, because we have to be able to, as the song from, I don't know if anyone ever saw the Broadway musical Ragtime. Nah, okay. So anyway, in the musical, there's this character whose name is Coleman, and Cole House sings this song, and it's a, go out and tell your story, let it echo far and wide, make them hear you, make them hear you, and tell them in our battle how justice was denied. Make them hear you, make them hear you, and say to those who blame us for the way we choose to fight, that sometimes there are battles that are more than black or white, and I will not put down my sword when justice was my right. Make them hear you, make them hear you. Go out and tell your stories to your daughters and your sons. Make them hear you, make them hear you, and tell them in our struggles we were not the only ones. Make them hear you, make them hear you. Your sword can be your sermon or the power of the pen. Teach every child to raise her voice, and then, my brothers, then, let justice be demanded by 10 million righteous men. Make them hear you. When they hear you, oh, I'll be near you again. Make them hear you, you guys. Tell your story. Let it echo far and wide. I am so very honored that Josh would have asked me to be here with you. Thank you. My mother lives in Oakland, California. I hope to be able to join your meeting at some point when I come out to see her. Thank you, Kate, for being for being our servant today and for being of service to this group and to all of you. Have a grand and glorious remainder of your weekend. And thanks for having me here.